Hello, I'm Bruce Sowry. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Financial Literacy Month continues, and we are really, really focused on financial readiness this month. This week in particular, we're going to look at financial readiness for people age 55 and up. Yvonne Zmecki from Home Equity Bank is here to talk about our financial readiness kit for that particular demographic. Then a look at how debt can affect your health, your physical and mental health. A recent study from the Urban Institute found that carrying any kind of debt can have a negative impact on health outcomes. Stepika Baraj is a senior research associate from the Institute, and they'll be here to talk about the findings. And whether you're already retired or soon to be, this new chapter of your life comes with a lot of change. Financial advisor Brad Gatto is going to be here to talk about his book, Spending Money and Having Fun, Your Practical Guide to a Fearless Retirement. Plus, have you been getting calls from a debt collector and do not know what to do about it? Carol Newbury Mitchell is a licensed insolvency trustee with MNP, and she's going to join us to talk about what collection agencies can and cannot do. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. We often think of financial health and physical health as two maybe connected but separate things. One can affect the other perhaps a lot more than we really appreciate. That's according to some new research. A study from the Urban Institute explored the health outcomes for older adults with and without debt. It found that carrying any debt had a negative effect. For more on the study's findings, we're going to talk to Stipisa Madrazia, a senior research associate from the Urban Institute, joining us now from Washington, D.C. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
What did you find when it comes to debt and the health impacts in older Americans?
Well, the study essentially finds that debt can be detrimental for older adults' health. Now, this is not to say that any type of debt is detrimental or that debt is negative in general. But some types of debt, especially what we call unsecured debt, so debt such as credit card debt as opposed to secured debt, which would be mortgages, for example, tend to have a negative impact on health.
And when you look at health, what are the measures that you were looking at? Is it obesity, blood pressure, rate of heart attack? Like, just bring to life what some of the things are that you would measure.
Yeah, so we looked at a pretty broad spectrum of health measures. So essentially, we looked at both subjective measures, such as self-rated health, then more objective measures, such as doctor-diagnosed health conditions, presence of limitations in the activities of daily living and instrumental activities of daily living, and the number of other measures, including the one that you mentioned, the obesity.
How can you determine what is cause and what is effect? Because I can imagine you've got diabetes, you can't work. Of course, you've got debt piling up.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually one of the main challenges of this research. And indeed, I would say one of the major contributions of what my colleague Barb Butrika and I did. So we know that people who are in poor health tend to rack up more debt. And so this is what we assumed going into this research, that this is a bi-directional relationship. So bad health leads to more debt, but we assume that we'll also be able to find a link between more debt leading to worse health. And so the way we did it is, without going to too many of technical details, we fit something called marginal structural model. And this is an identification strategy that is essentially very common in epidemiologic research, where researchers also grapple with many issues of causality. And so in essence, it's a two-stage process where we first estimate the probability that the subject person in the sample holds debt, and then we derive the weights in so-called inverse probability of treatment weights that are then used in the regression model to estimate that treatment outcome link. So essentially, the bottom line is we are reweighting the data in such way to break that reverse link and to make sure that we are looking at a relationship that has a causal link from debt to health.
In today's day and age, I mean, you look at the headlines of your research and it's a full-on nodder. Like, of course, that makes complete sense. What are the surprising findings? Because a cynic would say, oh, great, you just, you know, you proved that smoking is a problem, therefore you gave more ammunition to the anti-smoking lobbyists, but you're just proving something we already knew.
Look, the technical contribution of the research, I think, is really important because, you know, if it were easy, it would have been done already. And it wasn't. We actually needed to find techniques that would tell us that something that we think of as common sense actually has support in data. Now, I think we also opened up a whole new venue or avenue for future research, because what we found is that there is a causal link between debt and health. But that doesn't mean that we still understand the mechanism of how debt being saddled with debt is transferred into poor health outcomes. Now we are strongly suspicious of things such as having. Being nervous about having a lot of debt and some of these things essentially acting as transmission mechanisms, but we still really don't know much about the transmission mechanism that leads having more debt to being physically impaired, for example.
What are some of the policy implications of your findings, do you think?
Yeah, so I would say that one of the main policy implications is that we really need to be careful about how we promote different types of debt to people and what the social costs, the full social costs of debt are. At the end of the day, what we see essentially is that there are negative externalities. And so those who are selling those types of debt, they are not the ones who pay the price for it. So there's a lot of, as in many other aspects of the economy, there are a lot of negative externalities. And this is just a message to policymakers that, there's scope for their intervention to try to really mitigate some of these negative effects and still enjoy the positive aspects of debt, because we don't want to say here that debt is all negative. Debt actually can serve many positive roles. It's just about the prudent use of debt.
Mm. I'm going to draw the link back to cigarette smoking, because there was a time in which marketing of cigarettes was unregulated. People didn't fully acknowledge the health consequences of smoking. Do you think your research and studies to follow would play out in restrictions or requirements on the part of lenders?
They might, although I wouldn't really. So I would say that there are definitely some similarities, but I wouldn't draw a full, equal sign between smoking that we know is generally bad and that has both positive and negative aspects to it. And so I think here it's going to be in a way more difficult, because it really requires a more of a precision strike as opposed to, you know, blanket carpet bombing of the problem. And so here it's really about curbing the excesses. For example, you know, maybe things like payday loans or you know, things that are really undoubtedly contributing to poor outcomes of older adults and people more generally, rather than trying to curb that as such, which really plays an enormously important function in the economy.
What is your hypothesis on why there's such a difference between lower rate debt, like a mortgage, versus much higher rate debt, like even, let's say, not payday loans, but a credit card at 25% or whatever it is?
I would say really that it's not necessarily the interest rate that it carries, although that's an important aspect undoubtedly, but it's more about the type of debt and what the debt is used for. You know, mortgages are types of debt that we plan on for a long time. You know, it's a conscious decision for most people that they make. They may be saving up for a down payment. They may be, this is something that is really in the making for years. Also, if we think about things like car loans, now if someone buys a car because that allows that person to come to the place where they work, then it becomes an essential investment in essentially doing their job and earning income. So there's a sort of a counterpart to that debt. With credit cards, especially for people who may be not prudent or may just simply find themselves at a bad point in life, where, you know, they're short of money, they're between jobs, it can come to the point where it simply they cannot manage it anymore, and then the stress of having that probably kicks in, which then, you know, depending on what our individual level of preference for risk and stress is, and the ability of our body essentially to cope with such stress conditions kicks in, and really leads some people to this debt spiral, where basically then their health deteriorates, then they may start racking up health bills, incur more debt, and so on.
Right. All that. Thank you so much for your insight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stipisa Madrazia is a senior research associate from the Urban Institute, and he was here to talk about his research in the relationship between debt and health. Coming up next on Moolala, Yvonne Ziomecki-Fisher from Home Equity Bank takes us through the financial readiness kit for Canadians 55 plus. And later, I'll speak to Brad Gatto, retirement income certified professional, about his book, Spending Money and Having Fun, Your Practical Guide to a Fearless Retirement. And don't forget, we've got a newsletter. The place to sign up for that is moolala.ca. You can find out all sorts of things we were doing on CBC Radio and Sirius XM and CityLine and BNN and Global and blah, 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 blah.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. Our theme for Financial Literacy Month is the Financial Readiness Kit. I mean, certainly all Canadians are feeling the pinch of inflation right now, and they're seeing so much uncertainty in the geopolitical situation, with the climate, all sorts of things, questions about what's going to happen with the economy. But not all Canadians are affected by all this stuff in the same way. What readiness means to a 30-year-old may be quite different from a 55-year-old for a host of reasons. Credit Canada has developed a financial readiness kit for Canadians over the age of 55. It's one of a number that has been produced, one for youth, one for women. We're going to focus on 55 plus now with Yvonne Ziomecki-Fisher, Executive Vice President at Home Equity Bank. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello, Bruce. How are you today?
I'm great. What are some of the issues that you would highlight facing those over the age of 55?
I think there are a number of issues for that particular group that are very different for than any other demographic. So number one is their job or approach towards retirement. So what we've been hearing over the last few months post-pandemic, a lot of people, even below 65, 55 to 65, that are actually rethinking the future life and they're deciding to retire. So that has financial readiness consequences. The second one is inflation. It's impacting everybody. But for that group, if you think about those who are still on jobs or maybe have retired, their opportunity to earn more money is significantly more diminished than somebody younger. So they are not able to make more money because they're exiting the workforce. COVID and loneliness is a really big thing that has impacted that group, and it impacts their financial readiness.
Many people in that demographic rent and many own, but certainly if you are a homeowner and have been for a while and you're 55 plus, your circumstances are quite different from someone who's a relatively new homeowner at age 30. How does that dynamic for homeowners differ by age and stage?
So when you're older, let's say 55 or 65, you know, you should be at the point where you're paying off your mortgage. There's very little, if anything, left. And you're thinking about, you know, life after work. The reality is we are all living longer. You know, my life expectancy is still about 84. So we are living longer, working longer, and have to support ourselves in retirement longer. For somebody who owns a house in retirement, if they still have a mortgage right now, a lot of people are really worried about being in a variable rate mortgage because the mortgage payments are going up. So if you are not making any more money, or if you're thinking of retiring and all of a sudden the mortgage payments are going up, that is something that's definitely going to impact your financial situation. And you always have to remember, you know, regardless of what type of mortgage you have or how much you owe, you have to make sure that you have insurance on the home. You may have to make sure you're making property tax payments. So these are very, very important components for those people who are homeowners.
Cash flow is huge. If you are retired, that income essentially is fixed versus if you're still in your working years, you could, you know, get some overtime or work longer than you'd predicted. How do you ensure that you've got wiggle room to withstand surprises in that chapter of your life?
So that goes back to the preparedness fact, right? The preparedness point, because if you do it right now, any family right now probably is going to be short money because everything has gotten more expensive. The older you are, the less wiggle room you have, the harder it gets. So we always tell people at Home Equity Bank, and you know, I always tell people in my personal life, you have to be doing budgeting exercises once every few years. They're not fun. I hate tracking, you know, keeping track of all the expenses and adding them up and putting things in categories. But if you don't understand where you're spending money, it's really difficult to plan and prepare a budget. And then when things get tougher, it's really hard to know where you have wiggle room and where you don't. Mm.
Let's connect financial readiness with mental and physical health, because that, I mean, it's certainly where it, life is precarious for anyone, regardless of age. But as we become senior, as we pass the, you know, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, those issues become much more real and can change on a dime. I am a deluded optimist. I'm going to look amazing and be amazing till I'm 95, except for that may not be how it goes for me. And as a member of the sandwich generation, I've got parents who are aging, who went from amazing and perfect to, you know, dealing with some real things. How do you protect for that eventuality? And I say eventuality because if you're still alive, you're going to see diminished capacity.
Well, I think the physical, mental, and financial health are connected. So, you know, what we do is we work with people who are 55 plus. Our average client is 72. Hmm. I can't tell you how often it happens when we help somebody financially with providing our solution. We get letters, I get phone calls, emails telling us that, you know, yes, the financial element was one part of it, but their mental health has improved incredibly just overnight. They're able to do things that they, you know, always enjoyed, gardening, seeing friends, etc., you know, even leaving the house. We forget how serious the worry about financial is on a lot of people. And as you get older, your world can sometimes get smaller, and you may not be comfortable. You know, it could be, it could just be the societal norms. People are not comfortable talking about money. People are not comfortable having those discussions. So making sure that you're in good physical health, because it means you're probably interacting with other people. You have all the endorphins going, making sure that you're doing things that you enjoy. I think the three really, really work very closely together. And once one suffers, there are consequences for the other ones as well.
Home Equity Bank offers something called a reverse mortgage, which we've talked about on this show before. How does that particular product fit into financial readiness for someone 55 plus?
It fits for some people, not for all. I think, you know, it's a great solution for people who are in the retirement and for some reason, you know, they either don't have a pension or they don't have sufficient savings, or maybe they do have all those things, but they want to renovate or travel or gift money to families, especially now as younger generations trying to get into the real estate market. I think it's one of the tools and definitely, in my opinion, there's not enough people know about it and not enough people consider it. We have a lot of people who come to us kind of at the end of the rope because they've been going without. And going without could be, you know, not able to go out with friends or see your grandkids in the States. Meanwhile, they're living in a house that's paid off or partially paid off. And that's actually, you know, a pretty good investment they've made many, many years ago, buying the house, maintaining the house. And it's a bit of a mental game for some people to realize that they can actually take money out of that investment and invest in their future, in their well-being, and improve their life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a lot of really interesting conversations with people who are lucky to have that asset and are able to put it to good use. Hmm.
I want to ask you about some other things you would highlight in terms of financial readiness, but I also want to make sure everybody knows that they can download these financial readiness kits, and I say kits plural, at creditcanada.com/FLM-2022. FLM-2022. There's one for women, there's one for youth, there's one, a basic kit, and then there's one for seniors or for age 55 plus or age 55 or better. Yvonne, what are some of the other things that you would highlight that you believe are the metaphorical equivalent of the batteries and the flashlight and the candles and the tuna?
I think the one that I'm very passionate about are power of attorneys and wills. Mm. I see it on regular basis. I don't want to say daily, but probably weekly, where people have not done the planning, they haven't done the thinking, and something happens and it's too late. It's always too late. So I just looked up the stat before our call. 62% of Canadians do not have a will. Do not be that person who doesn't have a will. Do not be that person who doesn't have a power of attorney. It can make a bad situation even worse when you know, health things happen, when somebody passes away. To me, that is probably the most important part of the readiness kit.
I want to loop back to one other thing on cash flow just briefly, and that is people do some crazy things when they are stuck and they've been painted into a corner. You have an anecdote about home insurance, which that you shared with me, and I thought it was really relevant that people wouldn't necessarily understand. That is not a place to cut to save money.
No, so it's interesting. As you said, I've shared that with you. What we've noted in our customer base is, as you said, you know, people, things are getting tight, cash flow is getting tight, and people are starting to look at places where they could cut. And what we started noticing during, you know, coming out of the pandemic is that some of our clients, you know, they have to make trade-offs, and they started canceling their home insurance because they wanted to save on monthly expenses. That's not where you want to go. It's one of the things you need to have when you have a mortgage with any financial institutions. It's something you need to have for your protection. But if you don't have a lot of wiggle room, you know, there's only so much movement, you know, less food, or maybe you travel less, or you don't see your friends as often. But even with home insurance, you know, you can shop around and you can see if you can get a cheaper quote. So don't cancel your home insurance. Mm. It's absolutely crucial to have it for your protection.
And you'll find out, right? Like, that's not, there is a sharing of data. Is that, I couldn't just kind of pretend that I had it?
You can't pretend.
You can't pretend, Bruce. Okay, fine. I do have insurance. Just so everybody knows, I've got insurance. Yvonne, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure as always. Thank you for having me on the show, Bruce.
Okay, take care. Yvonne Zumecki-Fisher is Executive Vice President at Home Equity Bank, and she was here to talk about financial readiness. That is our big, big theme for Financial Literacy Month. And in particular, her focus was for Canadians over the age of 50.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, Brad Gatto will be here to talk about his book, Spending Money and Having Fun, Your Practical Guide to a Fearless Retirement. But first, what debt collection agencies can and cannot do, can and cannot say. Carol Newbery Mitchell from MNP will be our guest. For more Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca. That's on the web. You can listen to past episodes. You can also search by name, by guest name, or by topic. On any of the podcast platforms, you can also download the show, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Prime, wherever you listen to podcasts. While you're there, write a review, subscribe to the next episode.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When the debt collector calls and calls and calls and calls, it can be really, really, really stressful, especially if you don't know what your rights are, what collection agencies can legally do or not do. I heard of a case of where one said they were going to file a bankruptcy order on a client. Can they do that? I don't even know. To take us through some of their do's and don'ts, we're joined by Carol Newbery Mitchell. She is a licensed insolvency trustee with MNP LTD, MNP Limited. Hello there.
Hi there, Bruce.
What is a collection agency for those people who don't know?
Yes, a collection agency is a company, it's a business that is hired by other businesses, usually lenders or people who are in the game of lending people money, to collect debts on their behalf. They can also sometimes be collecting for themselves because sometimes they also purchase debt from those same companies.
And they make their money by what? Earning a commission on the money they collect?
Yes, usually exactly a commission.
So I referenced this case of where a collection agency said that they would file a bankruptcy order if the client didn't do X or Y. Could they do that? Would they do that?
Well, yeah, I think that's two really different things. So it's that's something I haven't actually heard before either. And I'm even in the bankruptcy business, as you know. But I guess down the road they could do that. But basically what it would require is the collection agency or perhaps the original creditor taking legal action against you. So whether that's first going to court to get issue a statement of claim and get a judgment against you, or, you know, I guess they could apply to court to get a bankruptcy order, but I think the cost of either of those things in most circumstances is usually much higher than the debt that they're collecting. And I would say, you know, those are things that they can threaten, but the likelihood of taking action on them is going to be dependent on those individual circumstances.
So the phone rings, you answer the call. What can the collection agencies say? What can they do? What can they say?
So of course there, you know, what you should do if you're the person receiving the call is you should first confirm who you're speaking to. You know, if they're calling in respect of a debt that you've never heard of, that you're unaware of, the first thing you should do is request confirmation of that debt in writing. So you can take a look at it and you can understand whether this debt seems to belong to you and whether you're actually responsible for it. You also want to make sure that you're talking to an actual collection agency, because unfortunately there are a lot of people out there that may misrepresent who they are and what business they're from. And so you want to make sure that it is actually a registered collection agency.
So you would say to them, thank you for your call. Can I get your name, your agency, your phone number, and can you mail me a copy of the debt that you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. In writing is really important for the collection agency business, because you actually have a lot of rights as an individual to request information in writing. And it's actually one of the ways that you can get them to stop calling you is to say, I want all future correspondence to come to me in writing. And you are legally allowed to do that.
Now, they can't call you any time of the day or night. What are the boundaries in which they can be in contact, and how many times can they call?
Yeah. So in Ontario, I can speak to that more directly, but in Ontario, they aren't allowed to call you more than 3 times in 7 days. But what I want to point out is that it's actually make contact 3 times in 7 days. So if they call you and you don't answer, that's not contact. So we get a lot of people coming to our office and saying, you know, they're calling me 7 times a day and I'm ignoring them and not answering the phone. Well, one of the reasons why they're allowed to keep calling you is because there's no contact made. And so that's something to understand. It isn't they can call you 3 times in 7 days. It's they can make contact 3 times in 7 days. So they also can't call you on statutory holidays. And I think the hours are between 7 and 9 on Monday to Saturday and Sundays 1 to 7, I think it is.
Am I correct in inferring that you recommend clients pick up the phone and answer that call?
Yeah. If they're not in a legal proceeding, such as a bankruptcy or a consumer proposal, I do recommend they pick up the phone because they can confirm those details, find out if this debt belongs to them, if it's a debt they need to deal with, find out who the collection agency is, and they can actually then, that's a contact. And so it's actually going to reduce the number of calls that they're getting.
I've also heard many examples of people who have items in collections that they didn't know about. And so by not answering those calls, they might not find out about something that is quite important to them when it comes to their it comes to their credit score. And sometimes they couldn't pay it, or sometimes they just didn't know. They moved to a different house and they just didn't get the envelope or whatever.
That's what I was just going to say, is the collection agency is also actually required to notify you in writing. And so people change their addresses a lot more than they change their phone numbers. So you may not be aware of a collection if it's just been done by mail, if you're not answering the phone.
When does this conversation become harassment? What, as the person on the receiving end, could I listen for? Are they allowed to berate me? Are they allowed to call me names?
No, absolutely not. So that's definitely one of the laws, is that they are not allowed to use obscene language, harass you. They can't, you know, just like you were kind of asked about in the beginning, they can't misrepresent what they're able to do. So for example, they can't threaten you with arrest. They're not allowed to charge you any collection fees. They can contact your employer, but only for the purposes of confirming your employment. They're not allowed to just repeatedly call and harass you at your at your place of employment. Mm. They're also allowed to call family members, but again, only to confirm your contact information, not to harass them to pay your debt.
What would you say about what happens after you move into a legal proceeding, like a consumer proposal or a bankruptcy? Do those calls, should those calls stop?
Yeah. So legally, they are required to stop because what gets put in place is a legal term, a stay of proceedings gets put in place and no legal action is allowed to continue against you, which includes question calls. Now, practically speaking, if at the time that someone files a proposal or bankruptcy, there might be a lot of different collection agencies contacting them. And sometimes the original creditor actually factors it out to a number of different collection agencies. And so it sometimes is difficult to capture every single one. So we often say, you know, if at a couple of weeks after you filed your bankruptcy or proposal, you're still receiving calls, pick up the phone. If it's not, doesn't cause you too much stress, pick up the phone, get exactly what we discussed earlier, get the company name, their contact information, details on the original debt, and then pass that on to us and we will get in touch with them and they should not have to deal with them for another moment after that.
For clients who are in this circumstance, it's, as I know, as you know, it is brutally stressful for these humans and mm-hmm. there is a real interest to get these calls to stop. However, in some cases, when you look at the big picture of their financials, paying $150 to one lender just to get it them to stop calling you isn't really the most appropriate next step. It could be that they just let that one linger and pay off, you know, something else, but you sort of need to have a full sense of what's going on in order to provide advice on that front. Mm-hmm. For people who are receiving those calls, what advice would you have for them to determine whether they should pay the $150 or $1,000 versus pay someone else who may not have as aggressive a collection agency working on their side?
Yeah, I think they need to sit down and look at their entire financial situation, possibly with a professional such as myself, a licensed insolvency trustee, because we will be able to go over their entire financial situation, who all their creditors, and determine what the best option would be for them given their other information like their income and their assets, et cetera. And sometimes that includes us. The best option includes us filing a bankruptcy or proposal. Sometimes the best option is going with something like a debt consolidation plan. And sometimes it is just determining which creditors to deal with in which priority, and they go about their business and they're able to settle their debt that way.
Now, one of the other dynamics that people don't have a real appreciation of is that some of this is negotiable. So with nonprofit credit counseling agencies, we negotiate lower rates. With a licensed insolvency trustee, you would be able to negotiate a consumer proposal that has your client not pay 100 cents on the dollar, often quite a bit less than that. Mm. What wisdom do you have on how to negotiate? What is negotiable?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think people also often find when they're dealing with collection agencies is that sometimes the collection agency shows up and says, well, the debt is 6,000, but we'll take 3. Mm. And again, looking at the bigger picture of their entire financial situation, if that's the only debt that's causing them problems and they can negotiate something that works for them with that creditor, that collection agency, you know, that might work in that situation. And, you know, in that situation, and the only caution I would say is get it in writing, get the agreement in writing from the collection agency. But for most people, I think that are usually in this position, they do need to negotiate probably a plan for all of their debts. And sometimes mm-hmm. that's hard to do outside of, like you mentioned, a not-for-profit credit counselor, or let's say a proposal or a bankruptcy. Mm.
Carol, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Bruce.
Carol Newbury Mitchell is a licensed insolvency trustee with MNP Limited, LTD. And our conversation was around collection agencies, what they can do, what they can't. And I think Carol and I would be in full agreement when we say to everyone who is on the receiving end of those calls, pick up the phone, call an LIT, licensed insolvency trustee, call a nonprofit credit counselor. There are many, many, many resources out there such that you do not have to have those conversations or have a lack of clarity on what your next steps could be. Stay with us. Coming up next on the program, Retirement Income Certified Professional. It's quite a long title, but that's what he is. Brad Gatto. He's going to talk about his book, Spending Money and Having Fun, Your Practical Guide to a Fearless Retirement. If you have a question about retirement, about collection agencies, about anything, our email address is ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The financial services industry spends an enormous amount of time, an enormous amount of energy on having clients accumulate retirement savings, building the nest egg, building. But at a certain stage, if you were lucky, you will change gears and you will start to spend that nest egg, decumulation. So what do you need to keep in mind as you make this shift? It is emotional, it is practical, there's a whole bunch of dynamics connected to it. Brad Gatto is joining us now to talk about that very thing. He is a retirement income certified professional, a designation we don't have here in Canada. He is president of Fiat Wealth Management and the author of Spending Money and Having Fun, Your Practical Guide to a Fearless Retirement. He's in Minneapolis. Hello there.
How you doing?
You begin with a metaphor about mountain climbing. How does that connect to retirement?
Maybe mountain climbing isn't something the vast majority of people have done in their life. And so maybe not exactly personally relational, but I think the other great example there is like climbing a tree. I think it's one point in all of our life, we've climbed a tree, or at least attempted to climb a tree. And one of the realizations when you're climbing a tree is when you get to the point where you're as high as you want to be or need to be or can be, is you kind of look down, and it's a daunting thought. Like actually getting back down the tree sometimes is a lot scarier than climbing the tree. And the path is usually different. You don't use the exact same branches or muscles. And so it's no different in life. You're a saver for decades. You literally live below your means. You save at least a dollar some point in time and live a lot of people well below their means so that they can save a significant amount of money with this idea that eventually I'm not gonna be able to work anymore, or I don't wanna work anymore. And so I need to have a pile of money set aside. And then all of a sudden this seismic shift happens where you get to the top of that mountain, to use that analogy, and you realize, you know what, this is great. And I'm super excited that I made it to the top of the mountain, but now I have this daunting task of getting back down. Yeah. And I've never done that before. Although I just got done climbing a mountain, I've never descended a mountain. And the path is probably a little different. The muscles you're going to use are a little bit different. And frankly, you're not a saver anymore. You have to become a spender. And it's a daunting task.
A fearless retirement is what you're hoping to foster for folks. There are some people who have a very practical, real, and visceral fear because they just don't have enough money saved. The retirement calculator is not on their side. But then there are other people who have fear connected to an irrational concern that they're going to run out of money. You have a very powerful anecdote of a client you were working with who had this aha moment in your presence to see that he actually did have more than enough to live any kind of retirement he could hope for. Tell us about that moment.
So this gentleman, when we kind of interacted with him or kind of found him in his story, he was already retired and had a small pension. He had a Social Security payment. But beyond that, and he had a significant pile of money, you know, things outside of these paychecks that he was getting, and wasn't really spending a lot of it. In fact, if I remember correctly, I think he was spending about $600 a month supplementing his Social Security pension. And we asked him the simple question, why aren't you spending more? Because he had talked about in our conversation some of his dreams, the things that he wanted to do in life. And so then, of course, begged the question, well, why aren't you doing these things? And to which he alluded to what you're talking about, the fear of, well, gosh, I don't know if I can afford to do it. I don't know if I have enough money. And so I just pulled out my phone because there's, you know, we all have calculators on our phones these days. And I just started doing the math of how much money he had set aside versus this $600 a month. And I just, you know, I looked at him and I said, did you know that if you took all of your money out of the market, because he had some irrational fears about the market too. He had one particular stock that he was invested in that just stopped paying a dividend. And that really had him worried. And I said, do you know, if you just took all of your money out of the market and you, you know, put it all in a, in between your mattress or buried it in your backyard in the Folgers can or something like that. And, you know, every month you went to the mattress, you went to the Folgers can, you just pull out that same $600. Do you know how long your money would last? And he said, no, I've never thought about it that way. And I said, 200 years.
Wow.
Your money would last 200 years. You don't need to be concerned about running out of money. If you were going to have any concerns, it would be how in the world am I going to spend all of this? And the correct answer is probably that you're not going to. So if you have fear around anything, it should be the idea of figuring out how to efficiently pass it to the next generation and who you want to give it to, because they're not going to let you take it with you.
You write that there is no freedom without boundaries. What does that mean? And what does that mean in this context?
Yeah, I love the analogy here of swimming in the ocean. And if you have an irrational fear of sharks, you're probably going to stay out of the ocean, right? That said, if there was buoys set up, you know, in an area in the ocean that said, hey, there are no sharks in this area, those are boundaries that are set up, but those boundaries actually create freedom for you. They don't limit you. Your fear is the limitation. You're going to stay out of the ocean in general because you don't understand where things are safe and where they're not safe. You just know that there's a possibility of things going wrong. And so the boundary in that scenario actually creates freedom. It doesn't limit you. And a lot of that is true of your finances as well. Like if you knew the answers to questions like, am I going to run out of money? If I spend this amount of money, is that going to be a problem? If I stay invested in the markets and we have a recession, is that going to put me on my heels or make it such that I'm going to run out of money? And if you could start to answer some of these questions and kind of put up these boundaries for yourself where you understand where the sharks are and where they're not, it can actually give you that, you know, that big kind of breath of like, okay, I can do this.
You have a whole chapter on this idea of the sequence of returns. So we've talked some about the mindset of this transition from accumulation to decumulation. And then there's the math. And there is some very real and, I don't know, concerning math about how you manage that decumulation and the order in which you pull your money out to put groceries in your fridge or take a trip or whatever. Tell us more about what that means and strategies people should employ to ensure that they're optimizing the sequence of returns.
Well, in your savings years, just putting money aside and investing the money and kind of closing your eyes and just, you know, opening your eyes the day you summit the mountain is actually for most people the best possible strategy. Because a lot of times when you actually look at the pile of money and you try to manage it, people end up becoming their own worst enemy and they trail market returns and these sorts of things. It's so different when you get there though. You can't just kind of ad hoc throw money in the markets and just kind of let it go. When you're spending, you have to be cognizant of when the markets go up and when they go down, because we do know both of those things are going to happen. And what we don't know is when they're going to happen and the timing of when the market's going to go up and when it's going to go down. And while that does not matter in your accumulation years, because if you have, you know, if you're the person that comes out of college and the economy is terrible the day you come out of college, and so you're the start of your savings career is in a depressive market or in a recessive state versus somebody that comes out of college in a really, really good time, but you both average the same rate of return over the 20, 30, 40 year period that you're in your savings years, you're going to end up with the same pile of money. It doesn't matter the timing of the return. All that matters is the average rate of return. But when you get to retirement, that's not true at all. You could average 7% and your neighbor could average 7% and your brother-in-law could average 7% and have the same set of facts, but the timing of when you get the returns can make it such that one of you dies a millionaire and the other one dies on Medicaid or dies broke. And it's because when you're pulling money out and using that money for your lifestyle, if you're pulling it out during a recessive state or when the markets are down, you're basically locking those losses in, and that does affect long-term, you know, the outcome or how long that pile, so to speak, is going to last. And so we've got to be cognizant of that. And as fearful and as scary as that sounds, there are answers, right? It's not like it's just this depressing, like, well, there's nothing you do. It just is what it is. And kind of hopefully you make it. It's not like that at all.
So give me some of the answers.
You need to bucket money.
Okay. You need to bucket money. Do you mean by asset class?
No, I mean by time. So we try to keep it super simple. Anything more than three for most people is too much. And so we have three buckets. So we have a now bucket, a soon bucket, and a later bucket. And the now and the later bucket are the easy ones. The now bucket is the money we plan on using to spend for your fun and lifestyle for the next year or two. depending on a certain set of facts, if we need a year, if we need 2 years, but keep it simple, we'll just say 2 years. And so that bucket of money is going to be basically non-risk stuff, cash and cash equivalents, because the markets are just so volatile in the short term that we just don't even want to play that game. So we're just going to leave it in cash. Now I don't have to worry about inflation a ton because it's very short-term money, although it is there. Later money, which is over 10 years. This is the money I don't need for at least 10 years. So I need some of it today. I need some of it soon. I need some of it later, right? The later money, we can leave it in the markets. If we've got 10 years to kind of let it bake, if you watch kind of market cycles, if we've got 10 years to be in equities, there's a 90-something-odd% chance we're going to end up with significantly more money than we started with. I like those odds. It's that weird middle bucket of, I can't let it sit in cash for any more than 2 years because then I really start to lose to inflation. And if I go to equities for anything less than 10 years, I'm not investing anymore, I'm gambling. And so that's where you've got to find some creative ways to get a little bit of growth on your money to kind of outdo inflation, but not be purely in equities. And so there's a lot of planning that goes into that bucket, and it can be a lot of different asset classes. And so I don't want to get too specific because actually it changes all the time and what makes sense in that bucket, but making sure that the time frame of when the money is going to be spent is imperative to how it's invested. The best analogy I can give you here is, can you imagine, Bruce, being 22 years old and you get out of college and you get your first job and you're going to pay 50 grand a year, you know, for 40 years plus, you know, pay raises or whatever. But instead of paying you every 2 weeks, they hand you your entire 40-year career paycheck at 22 years old. They hand you, you know, $2.5 million.
Vegas, baby, Vegas.
Right? What are the odds that that 22-year-old has any money left at 30, you know, let alone 65? But that's the daunting task you have when you retire, is you got this pile of money and it's your job for the first time in your life to budget it out. You know, we kind of complain about how often we're paid, every 2 weeks, once a month. But it actually forces habits and behavior on people that are positive, because you have to live within your means. Whereas in retirement, you don't have that. And so you got to create those boundaries for yourself.
So you, as I said in the title of your book, Spending Money and Having Fun. Why is that in the title of your book? We just got about 1 minute left.
Because this is, the fear is what drives a lot of people. And it's the number one emotion that comes out in retirement is, yes, you're happy you quit your job, you know, and then you finally get to do the thing. But the fear of like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I have enough. Am I going to run out? Am I making decisions and all that kind of stuff? It shouldn't be that at all. We talk about this every day as Saturday lifestyle at Fiat all the time. And that's what I mean by that. In order for you to have fun, you need to have the hard questions answered so that you can get rid of the fear and not just spend the money, but have fun doing it and not have this innate fear of every time you go to spend money that it's going to cause a problem.
The book is Spending Money and Having Fun, Your Practical Guide to a Fearless Retirement. The author, Brad Gatto. Brad, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely, Bruce. It was a ton of fun. Thanks for having me.
Brad Gatto is also the president of Fiat Wealth Management. That is our show for today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. And if you have comments, questions, stories, ideas, story ideas, feedback, whatever it is, our email address is the best way to get a hold of us. ask@moolala.ca. That's moolala.ca. If you want to subscribe to our newsletter, that's at moolala.ca. The website, you can subscribe to the podcast version of this show on any of the podcast programs out there. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.